Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Dead Frog Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Felix. This is a podcast dedicated to analyzing, understanding, and dissecting the art of stand-up comedy. Today we'll be covering Bill Hicks's band set on the David Letterman show. That one was supposed to air August 1st, 1993. Actually, if you guys don't know about this particular set, there was a lot of commotion since it was the first set he was the first stand-up to be censored at the Ed Sullivan Theater. There are plenty of write-ups about the incident, and years later, Letterman would actually play this on the show. There was a New Yorker write-up that is very interesting to read. I do recommend it. It came out in November 1st, 1993. But there, they describe Hicks, the late, great Bill Hicks, as a tall, 31-year-old Texan with a pudgy face, aged beyond its years from hard living on the road, which feels pretty rude. But nonetheless, it does describe who he is mentally, someone who is aged beyond who they were at the time. And with me to discuss the set, I have one of the, I guess, best comics in LA. He's been doing it for a long time. Actually, very talented guy. He's a writer, stand-up actor, filmmaker out of Dallas, Texas. He's appeared on both seasons of Roast Battle. He's actually been dubbed one of the best roasters in LA by Jeff Ross himself. He's a regular at the Comedy Store. He's opened for Dave Chappelle. He actually wrote and directed 2011's Shock Jock, which screened at the Cannes Short Film Festival. He recently became a contributor on HBO's Crashing, fantastic show, and staff writer for the Discovery Channel's BattleBots reboot. But mainly, he's here to promote his new album, soon to be released August 14th, Good Guy with a Gun. You can pre-order it now, you know, as an early birthday gift for him. Please welcome to the pod, Jay Light.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I'm very excited to have you here, man. It's on the cusp of one, I think, big milestone for you, right?
Yeah, big milestone. Album is something that I've had in my sights for a long time. It's cool that it's finally getting released.
What was the whole process like for that?
So what I did was I've been doing stand-up. It'll be 10 years this October. I don't know how much to count this year just because COVID really changed the way that everybody's doing stand-up these days. I've been performing here and there, but anyway, it's semantics. 9 years of me performing, I was like, all right, I'm hitting this point where I have a body of material that I feel very proud of, and I would like to also stop doing it. Like, I was starting to get tired of some of my jokes that I'd been doing. But I didn't want them to just go away. I wanted to put them down on wax and make sure that they at least were, you know, fossilized isn't the right word, but we're going to go with it. So I went to, I started, you know, figuring out, okay, this is probably the material that I'll do in the album. This is the stuff that I want to work out that I think could fit on the album. I booked a bunch of long sets on the road. Tried to do as many long sets as I could in Los Angeles. I was accepted to perform at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival last summer, which is this big, you know, month-long comedy and arts festival. And I performed there every single night, pretty much. You perform your own show every day of the festival. I did an hour of stand-up comedy pretty much every night that I was there. And then I came back, I recorded it at the Pack Theater. I added some extra elements to the album. I was working with this producer, this guy, DJ Coach T, who is the DJ at Roast Battle, and he's worked on a bunch of other comedy projects. But he and I, you know, we've developed a good working relationship and friendship over the years. I knew that I wanted him to be the producer. He's produced albums for comics like Chris Rock and Jamar Neighbors and other great comics. So I wanted him to help out and produce mine. So we got the stand-up recorded. Then we recorded some sketches. We recorded a roast battle at the Comedy Store. And those are all incorporated on the album along with some musical interludes from Coach T. And the whole recording process took about 3 months, maybe 4 months. We were basically chopping up stuff from August of last year until about November of last year. The album was finished and edited together early this year. Was in talks with a label to try and sell it up until the springtime. And then we are releasing it in conjunction with All Things Comedy and 800 Pound Gorilla Records. And yeah, it's just exciting to, you know, to work and have this the fruits of my labor that I've put together over the course of the past almost decade of doing stand-up, just see it out in the world.
That's fantastic. And I also like the almost like the victory lap that you kind of described at the Edinburgh Festival, because you're doing it almost every night, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
At any point were you thinking, or did you ever feel like a second wind with the jokes where you're like, you know what, these are pretty good actually? Or like,
well, that's the thing is, I really loved the jokes. Like I just got tired of telling some of them. And then some of them started to feel like, you know, maybe they were a little not as timely as I was hoping that they might be. I mean, I feel like the material on the album is ultimately pretty evergreen, especially given some of the timeliness of some of the issues that get brought up on the album and some of the things I make jokes about. But overall, the thing I got the most out of doing Edinburgh Fringe was figuring out part of the reason maybe why I didn't think a joke was working is because it was in the wrong place. You know, I went to Edinburgh with this idea of like, okay, this is what my hour will look like. And then I wound up coming back with a very different order and a very different structure to what ultimately became Good Guy with a Gun.
Oh, really? So it was how those jokes were received in particular that changed that.
Yeah, I think Edinburgh itself is a really crazy festival. If you haven't, or if your listeners haven't, I would definitely recommend checking out the documentary Hannibal Takes Edinburgh, which is about Hannibal Buress doing the Edinburgh Fringe. I'm pretty sure there's other documentaries about the Fringe, but that one was the one that really put that festival on the radar for me. Yes. And it's such a great opportunity because you're doing an hour every day, you're performing on other shows, and you really get a chance to see how the stand-up, how your jokes fit together in a way for a non-American audience. You know, there were Americans there, but I was performing for people from all over the world, people who didn't understand the references or people who I had to change the references for. You know, there are some jokes that only work in America. There are some jokes that I was doing strictly for the European audiences. But what I love about stand-up, one of the things I love about stand-up is how flexible it all is and how malleable it is. And having to see and change everything day by day based on the reaction from the night before, it really tickled my like analytic comic brain. Yeah, so that really speaks to
your ability, since you're someone who has such a catalog of jokes, and your ability to read the room well enough in the moment, because there is a feeling of being on stage and then sort of realizing this might not be going as well as it could be. And so you take a pause and you're like, okay, let me pull out the old Rolodex. And you're like, oh yeah, that's going to work here.
Right. And I, you know, and not just from being in the moment too, though, that comes with like, I have to sit down. I made it a point every day that I was at the festival to go. There was a coffee shop I loved going to. At some point in the day, I would sit down, get a cup of coffee, maybe grab a snack, and then I would listen to the set from the night before, or if I'd done multiple sets, because there are other shows you can do, I would listen to those sets and take very extensive notes on like what worked, what didn't work, if there was a way I was saying something that was working better than it had a different night, if there were jokes that, you know, a throwaway line or a new line or a tag or something that I'd thrown in that worked really well. If I tested out something in a different order and it seemed to work better in that order, I would make a note of that. It's really like shaping and sculpting is a lot of what was going on at that festival for me. But that's something that, you know, I always love the craft of stand-up. I think stand-up is an art form, but it's also a craft. And I think that the best comics are master craftsmen.
Oh yeah, it's definitely something that should be like further recognized to be on par with like the institutional arts. It just happens to take place in a bar.
Right. Yeah. It's just, you know, you're performing for drunks and people who are not necessarily going to agree with you all the time and will vocalize that. And it's a much more do or die kind of art form than a lot of other,
yeah, definitely,
you know, filmmaking or live theater or any of that kind of stuff. But it's so vital.
Jay, and how much of this recording, how much of it was there like a reflective process on like the past decade of you working?
How much of the recording was a reflective process? Well, when I was, you know, conceiving how the album was going to wind up feeling and the structure to it, I sort of found myself thinking a lot about how the material on the album is primarily me looking back on things that happened to me, situations I found myself involved in, aspects of my personality that were from the past. So the whole album is practically a reflection, because it's all commentary of me commenting now on how things were back then.
Gotcha.
And one of the other things that sort of led me to think about things that way, I had a lot of conversations with other comics and other creatives about what I was saying on stage and my perception and how audiences look at you and how they receive you. And I was really deeply thinking, oh, okay, I'm talking a lot about what I was like. I think there needs to be a point where I can like put that down and address more things about like how I look at the world now, and not specifically how am I looking at what happened now. Like, I want to try and update and be more current,
yeah,
of a comic. And I think having this album is essentially serve as an introduction to like, all right, this is the kind of comic and person that I am, and these are the kinds of things I'm going to make jokes about, and you can take it or leave it. And I needed to have that and be able to put that to bed in order for me to feel like I can work on stuff that's new and more me now.
Yeah, that's cool. You in a sense are like ushering in a new conceptual framework for yourself.
But yeah,
by letting this other one kind of go. Yeah.
Exactly. That is the most highfalutin smart way you can put it, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I had it written right here in my notes. New conceptual framework. Try to work this into the conversation.
Good job. You did it. Seamless.
Okay, cool. Thanks. That's great. And where do you? I'm sorry if you don't have an answer to this, but where do you see it going now?
The album, you mean?
No, sorry, your comedy. How is it going to differ? How do you expect it to?
Where do I see my comedy going now? That's such a tricky question, just because there's so much right now with the state of comedy in the world that's up in the air. I think that I've been thinking a lot about this over the course of the pandemic, and I feel like there are some of the like weird elements about me, like the weirder tics or idiosyncrasies and things I believe, that I hadn't really gotten a chance to delve into in stand-up.
Yeah.
Or ways of performing that I hadn't really thought about to delve into. Like, I've been performing a little bit during all of this, but the primary thing that I've been doing, one of the biggest kinds of shows, is not a stand-up show. I've been doing a show where I'm performing in character every week, sort of like improvised character improv, for like the Twitch channel for the Pack Theater, doing a fake eBay sales show. And that is certainly not stand-up at all, but it's me performing in a way that I years ago wouldn't have even considered just like, oh yeah, that's something I can do. So I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what can comedy look like for me after this? Like, what can I do to perform that makes me feel like I'm doing something that's uniquely me and not just something that you can go see? Like, one of the things that I really wanted to focus on with this album in particular is I didn't want it to just be another white guy telling jokes. Those kinds of albums are a dime a dozen. Mm-hmm. And I think I had this album conceived and just helped or worked with Coach to structure it in such a way that it is not that. It is something different. And so now I got to figure out on the next wave of performance, what does that look like for me? And I don't really know 100%, but I do know that there are things that I want to tap into. Not sure how I wind up tapping into them, but I've got some ideas. We'll see.
Yeah. I think early on as a comic, I think it almost bifurcates into two camps where you're like, I need to stick to tradition. I need to be a very writey, a very punchy sort of comedian. Or you're someone who's like, I was so influenced by Kaufman. I was so influenced by character work that you're like, I'm going to get into this medium through this lens. Mm-hmm. And you kind of, in trying to be a good comic, sometimes you find yourself just sticking to one area of comedy. And it's nice to know that, and is this in virtue of you taking classes or working on improv at the PAC?
You know, I think that I have some influence from there, certainly. As far as like my journey in LA has gone, I started out working at the Comedy Store pretty close after I moved to Los Angeles. And I began comedy in North Carolina. When I started doing stand-up, I was pretty straightforward, like write a joke, tell a joke. I wasn't really trying to do anything different with performance. And then as I started to work at the Comedy Store and perform there more and do roast battle, I started to think about a performance-y element. And then being involved in improv at the PAC changed the way I thought about performance and trying to think about just like, how can I just go for the joke? Like, how can I just try and be funny, but also connect with an audience?
Yeah.
And be present. Like, I think presence is a really hard thing to achieve for stand-ups, just because it's, you're up there, you're in the moment. Sometimes you just want to go through and do your jokes, right? And sometimes you want to do crowd work and be loose. You know, I think I started doing a lot more crowd work once I started doing improv. And I think it opened the way up to like, this is me performing in different ways than I would have when I started. I think the more I do these shows in quarantine too, I think I'm really interested to see how it feels to be doing stand-up in front of live audiences again after this. Because I really don't know what it's going to look like, but I'm just going to go with the flow. The times I have done live shows here and there, it feels fun and different, you know, because I'm there. I'm physically, I feel present in a way that I don't think I did on stage for a really long time.
Really?
It's really easy to go automatic, you know? It's really easy to just sort of like tell your jokes, just sort of retreat into your head and not be there and be in the room.
It feels very particular as a stand-up to be able to do that. I mean, you can do that at an office job and zone out and like go through the motions. But there seems to be something like as a stand-up when you kind of, if you accidentally slip into the sort of auto drive and mm-hmm. you're like, how am I both performing and thinking about like what I'm going to eat after this?
Right. Well, that's the thing I love about improv is improv forces you to be in the moment. And at the Comedy Store, the comics I liked watching the most were the ones who you could tell were there in the moment. I love people who can handle an audience, you know, reacting a way that you might not expect to a joke well. I love comedians who can handle crowd work very well. There's something about that just feels very of the time and very vital to me. Like you're using your time on stage well. Like that's a tricky thing to pull off as a stand-up. it takes a lot of effort, but I think if when comic is willing to put in that effort, then magic happens. And that's those are the moments I like seeing the most. The moments that really feel like, oh, this is something that we are experiencing together, and we're not going to get to see. This is a moment for us. We're capturing it for us now.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of like the biggest motivating, like I guess, aesthetic features of improv that drew me to. I think maybe a lot of people share that, because it's like we try to capture so much of these fantastical moments, of memorable moments on tape or through some other method, that we sort of take away value from that moment as being something that can't be replicated. And I lived in that headspace where I was like, I'm not going to take a picture of this moment, because I'm just going to, I don't want to be the condescending guy who's like, because I want to live in it, right? But there's just, I don't want to take away that particularity about it. And I like listen to myself tell stories of like events that happened. And then I'm like, am I elevating that incident, or am I taking away from it by letting it be exposed to people who weren't there, you know?
Yeah, I think that that's all interesting stuff to consider. You know, I think it's tricky to think about that in a stand up way too, because compared to improv, where you have a group of people who you're performing with who are there to catch you, stand up there is no safety net. Like, your jokes are really all you have is a safety net. I remember one of my friends, this guy Nate Hurd, he at a certain point told me. I think we were about, maybe it was like 2 years ago. So maybe we're about, he was a little bit more ahead of me in stand up, but we're both pretty close. So we'd probably like 8 and 10 years maybe. Okay. And he told me, you know, there comes a point, and we're at this point where like you can go on stage and perform, and you can decide whether you're going to do well or whether you're going to take a risk.
Yeah.
Like, there comes a point when you have enough material that you know works, because you've tested it and hammered it and made it into the finest, like, Hattori Hanzo steel that you can make that joke, right?
Yeah.
And you get to that point, and you just put it in your sheath, and you're ready to use that whenever you need to. But it's cool to be able to do that, and it's cool to be able to kill doing that material, but it's not necessarily the thing that fuels good artistic growth. And I think after a certain point, you just have to, you either decide you're going to keep killing and be happy with that, or you're going to try and push yourself to take some risks and maybe do stuff that's not necessarily going to work. And I think that's where the presence comes in too, because you have to be present in order to make that choice. Yeah. You can't be automatic. Autopilot, great. You can kill an autopilot. I've seen comics do it. But if you really want to take the risk, you have to be there in the moment with everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's not easy.
It's not. Jay, I think at this moment, the listeners have, like, just know who you are as an artist. I think you're giving us so much. And I'm sorry to say this, but I think we need a cut to break, so that I don't know how else to say it.
No, it's a good. You're saying it exactly how you should say it.
Yeah. So please stick around. You're about to listen to Bill Hicks on Letterman, and you're gonna hear a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back after that.
Okay. So we're gonna take a look here tonight, and. I want you folks to enjoy this, honestly. Here he is now doing stand-up comedy on this stage in a segment that I had taken out of our program October 1st, 1993. Here's the very funny Bill Hicks.
Thank you. Good evening. Very excited to be here tonight, and I got some great news today. I finally got my own TV show coming out as a replacement show this fall. Yeah. Thank you. It's not a talk show. Don't worry. It's a half-hour weekly show that I will host entitled Let's Hunt and Kill Billy Ray Cyrus. Thank you. It's fairly self-explanatory. Each week we let the hounds of hell loose. We chase that jarhead, no-talent, cracker idiot all over the globe. So I finally catch that fruity little ponytail of his, pull him to his knees, put a shotgun in his mouth. Then we'll be back in 94 with Let's Hunt and Kill Michael Bolton. Also look out for our Vanilla Ice, MC Hammer, Marky Mark Christmas special. And I don't want to give away any surprises, but Marky Mark's the first one we catch and kill on that show because his pants kept falling around his ankles and he couldn't run away. I crossbow him right in the ab. Bring the whole kids, the family and everything. It's a Christmas spectacular. I don't know what my deal is. I'm like a 31-year-old curmudgeon. That's the deal. You know, I went to a dance club the other day, you know, and dragged against my will, you know. And this girl asked me to dance, which I thought was hilarious, you know. Would you like to dance? You know, I'm like, yeah, you read my mind, you know. That's why I'm leaning in the darkest corner closest to the exit, you know. I'm about to boogie. I'm about to cut a rug. But it's weird. Women have this weird myth. You can tell the way a guy is in bed by how he is on a dance floor. I think that's ridiculous. What does it matter? You know what I mean? If a guy is on a dance floor really getting into it, enjoying himself, expressing himself, what does it matter how he is in bed? He's gay. Real men don't dance. They sit, sweat, and curse. Speaking of homosexuality, you know, I consider myself fairly open-minded, but something has come to my attention I find absolutely shocking. I don't know if you've heard about it. These new grade school books for children to teach them gay lifestyles. You know what I'm talking about? One of them is called Heather's Two Mommies. The other is called Daddy's New Roommate. I'm going to have to draw the line here, folks, and say this is absolutely disgusting, okay? It is grotesque and evil. I'm talking about Daddy's New Roommate. Heather's Two Mommies is pretty cool. I don't know if you really check that out. They're hugging on page 7. Oh, go, mommies, go, go. Anyway. Makes me miss my youth. People annoy me. You know what's really annoying me? These pro-life people. You ever look at their faces? I'm pro-life. Boy, don't they look it. They just exude joie de vivre, you know? You see them trying to go to an orphanage and adopt a kid. We're pro-life. We're here to adopt. Kids are just, oh, don't pick me. Oh, no. I'll eat gruel, 15 to a bed, no problem. Just keep Heather's Two Mommies coming and we're fine in here. I'm pro-life. You know, if you're really pro-life, do me a favor. Don't lock arms and block med clinics, okay? If you're so pro-life, do me a favor. Lock arms and block cemeteries, okay? Let's see how committed you are to this idea. She can't come in. She was 98. She was hit by a bus. There's options. Are we going to have her stuffed? What are we going to do with her? We're pro-life. That's the same look smokers give you, too. I'm a non-smoker. I'm a pro-life non-smoker. I'm getting that look a lot these days because I started smoking again, and I had 9 months without a cigarette, and I started again, and I'm getting that look. Are you applauding me starting or stopping? What are you? The smokers are, hey, you're back. Non-smokers, it's terrible. I can't believe he started again. Why? After 9 months. I have this belief. If that scenario is at all true when you die and you go to heaven and St. Peter meets you at the gate, I have this belief. The first thing he's going to ask you is, you got a light? You mean y'all smoke here? Yeah, that's why it's heaven. These aren't clouds. This is cigarette smoke, pal. Hell is the non-smoking section. You want to look at them for a minute? Okay. I can't believe what they do to their bodies. It's so smelly. It smells like an ashtray. Why do they want me to smell that? God, that's hellish. Exactly. Light up and come on in. Hendrix is on harp tonight. So I've been traveling. I was in Australia. I was in Australia over Easter, which was interesting to note. They celebrate Easter the same way we do, commemorating the death and resurrection of Jesus by telling our children a giant bunny rabbit left chocolate eggs in the night. I wonder why we're messed up as a race. Anybody got any clues? I've read the Bible. Can't find the word bunny or chocolate anywhere in the book. Why those two things? Why not, you know, goldfish left Lincoln logs in your sock drawer? You know, just making stuff up. Go hog wild. But I think it's interesting to note how people act on religious beliefs. You know what I mean? Like a lot of Christians wear crosses around their necks. Nice sentiment. But you think when Jesus comes back, he's really going to want to look at a cross? Ow. That may be why he hadn't shown up yet. Going, man, they're still wearing crosses, Dad. I'm not going. No. They totally missed the point. I'm not going. Forget it. I'll go back as a bunny. But,
just great.
He looks
tremendous. And I've not seen that videotape or any part of it since that night. And seeing it now, it raises the question, what was the matter with me? What was I thinking? That was just tremendous. He if anything, it says a great deal about me. It says more about me as a guy than it says about Bill, because there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. Just perfect. And the fact that, and I expected it to be somewhat dated being that old, and it's not. It's just great. He, in fact, I guess this speaks to the suggestion that he was way ahead of his time. Mary, this has been a good night for me, and I hope a good night for you.
It's been a very good night.
God bless you.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you. We'll be right back with the Gaslight Anthem, everybody.
Jay, that was such an excellent clip.
Yeah, right? It really is something. Quite a set.
I think you can feel the energy, like, through, like, the video. I know it's an audio experience for the listeners, but, you know, if you have the opportunity to watch it on YouTube, it's really something. Why Bill Hicks?
Well, Bill Hicks is a comic who I really love on like a deep level. And he's not the comic who like I would listen to all the time now. You know, I mean, at this point, I'm not listening to a ton of comedy as it is. I'll watch some specials or some clips every now and again just to see what's going on. But when I first got interested in doing comedy at all, I listened to a handful of comics religiously, and Bill Hicks was one of those comics. There's this album Rant in E Minor. It's I think it's his first posthumous album.
Yeah.
And I listened to that. I worked as a summer camp counselor for many years. And I remember there was one summer where I had just gotten that album. I think I was either like had maybe done a couple open mics, or I was very fresh and hadn't done any open mics, but I'd started writing jokes. But I would listen to that album almost every night that summer when I would come back from post putting the kids to bed counselor hangout time.
Yeah.
And I would just listen to that on my iPod and constantly just the way that his jokes, like his word choice is so great. His energy when he's performing is so great. And the topics that he talks about, I also think it's very hard to make jokes about, especially with the level of like sort of passion and anger that he has, and make them funny, but he pulls it off.
Do you feel like you need to have an edge to be good?
No, I don't think you need to have an edge. It's a case-by-case basis, right? You know, there are comics who are super clean, you know, relatively family-friendly, who are fantastic. You know, I love Nate Bargatze, for instance. I wouldn't call Nate like a clean, family-friendly comedian by any means, but I also wouldn't say Nate is performing edgy material, right? I think that...
Well, maybe the word is angst. Or some combination of the two. You have to get off your chest.
I think that makes a little bit more sense. I think if you have, well, because all comedy is, if you really want to boil it down, right, is you expressing your opinion and trying to do it in a funny way. Yeah. And to a large degree, and, you know, credit to Eric Moneypenny at the PAC Theater for this, but comedy is a bargain between you and the audience. All comedy, stand-up, sketch, improv, whatever. It's a bargain between you and the audience to find what you find funny and what they find funny.
Yeah.
And the Venn diagram of that overlap, that's where your jokes, where your material lies. So I think some people have to figure out where that overlap is. But, like, I think for me... And for comics like Bill Hicks, you have to see, like, okay, this is the kind of stuff that he was passionate about and the stuff that he wanted to talk about and get off his chest. This is the stuff that he felt he needed to say. And as long as he was able to work the jokes in there, then the audience was able to get on board with it too. And that's a real tough act to pull off.
Yeah. Okay. Do you mind if we get into the material now?
Let's go for it.
Okay, so this opening, right? Great news. I'm gonna have a replacement TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It feels very strong. He doesn't open up with a very quippy one-liner. He opens up with something that's gonna lead into, like, I guess a series of tags or like of build-ons,
right?
By naming more and more sort of maybe loathed pop culture references.
Yeah, and it's the kind of intro that you can only do on television if you're a comic who's been in the game for a while and who's a known commodity. I'm sure you've noticed watching people's first sets on TV, they kind of have to do the jokes where it's introducing the audience to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I open my album as far as once the stand-up gets going, I open the album with a joke that's about my looks. You know, I say I'm Jay, I have camp counselor face.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that, like, you learn to do those jokes when people don't know who you are and you have to get them on board with you really quickly. So to see, this is, you know, this was supposed to be his 13th appearance.
Yes.
This isn't the kind of joke you can tell. You can't intro on a setup like this on, like, your first, second, third, maybe even like your fifth set, I would imagine. This is, you can tell he's a seasoned, not only a seasoned professional comedian, but also somebody who understands how to structure a set for television.
Yeah, exactly. You clearly outlined exactly what's happening here. And then I like that. Yeah. Then later he actually introduces the sort of theme, like his character. Maybe if you don't realize who Bill Hicks is, he does mention that he's a 31-year-old curmudgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that both reflects what he just said in talking about murdering all the celebrities.
Right.
But it also gives a cushion up for this new, this next joke that he's going to say, which is about, you know, him being at the club.
Yeah, the joke about him not wanting to dance.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, it's sort of, there's a, not to get into it too much, but there's a bizarre logic there. Where he doesn't want to dance and he's in the corner close to the exit. But if he doesn't want to do that, why is he there to begin with?
Right.
But the logic is set up top by saying, well, he's a 31-year-old curmudgeon, right? He's still young relatively, and he's doing the thing that I guess people of that age do, but he has this character aspect that makes him not want to do that.
Right. Like, he knows he still has to go to the bar and do the whole trying to get out, trying to get laid or trying to date thing. Doesn't mean he's gonna like doing it.
Yeah. So he's also very good at detail. Every line is painting a picture. There's nothing really left to the abstract.
Yeah, his way with words is really excellent.
Yeah, and he's able to pick up the pace, but also slow things down. With like, he sets up this one-liner by saying something like, women say they can tell how a man is by the way he is on the dance floor. And he says floor a little longer than the rest of it. And then that's where he's slowing down the pace for like what you would normally see to be a one-liner. Right, because from what I've noticed, you either have like a Bob Saget sort of one-liner thing, or you have a much more slower delivery for one-liner to like be very clear about the misdirection. And if you disagree, let me know. But that's what I noticed there.
Yeah, no, he's really trying to rope the crowd in. He's getting them on his wavelength. He's squeezing every last bit of tension he can out before he cuts the tension with the next line, with the actual punchline of the joke.
Yeah, like, what does it matter how he dances? You know, he's gay,
right?
And then he starts talking about these gay lifestyle books, which I think is another sort of very quick joke that really, as you mentioned right now, draws out tension. And he's, I think, yeah, he's very particular in his choice of words. After he describes, these two disgusting books, according to him, Heather's Two Mommies and Daddy's New Roommate.
Yes.
He mentions that these are disgusting to create a sort of contrast from...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love what he's doing in this section in particular. Because there's a clear element here that, the first thing he does right after he says he's talking about, here are these books they're having in schools now. He says, now I'm open-minded. But folks, I think this is a little too far. Yeah. So he's first of all establishing, he's trying to ingratiate himself with the audience by saying, now I'm open-minded, right? And then he does the flip by saying it's too far. And you can hear during this set, obviously this is a different time, and there are people in the crowd who like clap and cheer when he says, I think this is too far. Because there are people who think that he is agreeing with them.
Yeah.
Only to flip that and show that he's been making fun of those people the whole time.
Yep.
With the punchline of the joke.
Yeah, you nailed it. And I think that's one of the best things to do as a comic. It's kind of like a fun little social service by like outing the bigot in that setup. It was super concerning to hear that woo.
Right, and it's very, you hear that and you're like, uh-oh, where's he going to go with it? And then you see the moment where he proves that he's still on the right side. Yeah. And it's a tough thing to pull off, I remember I was doing a show in Austin, Texas, and Austin's a very, Texas, where I grew up, red state, of course, Yep. But Austin is a pretty liberal city, but there's still pockets of, conservatives in the city. Now, I don't really do a whole lot of political material, but I have jokes that sort of hit touch points that people who are conservative might think about differently than people who are liberal. I remember doing some of these jokes, and these are jokes where I'm like making fun of a concept, right? And they are the kind of jokes that ultimately people will laugh at because it's funny above their own political beliefs. Like if you hear me make this joke about gun control or about religion, and you're in a conservative audience, even if you don't agree with like my viewpoint on the subject, my goal is to try and get you to laugh at it no matter what. And I remember I did this show in Austin one time, and one of the other comics on the show came up to me afterwards, and she said, it's crazy that I don't even think they knew that you were making fun of them.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, whatever works. But like, you know, I am making fun of you and your viewpoints.
Yeah.
But that's what you got. Sometimes you just gotta, that's the kind of thing like you have to learn by working. This is, you can tell that Bill Hicks is a road guy with a joke like this. Because in the road, you're performing outside of the cities where people tend to be more liberal in cities and people are more conservative outside of cities. That's just, it's a generalization, but it's in my experience and in anyone who's done the road a lot, it's a pretty common experience, I think, to run into that. And everybody deserves to laugh.
Yeah.
As long as you can show that you're capable of putting your opinions in a way that make you the person who's like not the butt of the joke,
mm-hmm.
and show that like I'm gonna turn it on you and I think you're wrong, but I want you to laugh at how wrong you are.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. I'm reluctant to mention this, but there is a people really believe, some people really believe that like comedian or comics are the new philosophers, right? I think there is, mm-hmm. Some of that, there's some truth in that, like, you know, there's that whole the apology by Plato, right? And you know,
mm-hmm.
Socrates is like last days, he's about to drink was it from the gimlet or whatever?
Yeah, I guess so.
Poisoned, and then, but like in that speech, it's like he's able to, like, if you ever get a chance to read, or if you read it, it's kind of funny because he sort of reflects how asinine society is, like his current position in time. And
mm-hmm.
he kind of does the same thing that Bill Hicks is doing, where it's like he leads you to believe that you're safe and that he's preaching what you, like he's agreeing with you, but then he turns it on you at the end. And I think that's been a longstanding tradition with comics in the best way possible, to sort of have people reflect on their own beliefs. And like, if you like, just like Bill Hicks did this with the but you know, Heather's Mom, you know, Heather's Two Moms, that's pretty cool.
Heather's Two Mommies, that's pretty cool. Because that's the thing, he first of all shows that like the belief that those people who are cheering and clapping at him saying we shouldn't have books that show gay couples to children, he's saying, okay, you think that this is correct, you believe this, but you're also going to think that this is total, like you're going to be in the same mind frame that I'm satirizing when I say I think Heather's Two Mommies is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that's so ridiculous. He's holding, it's a moment where he's holding the mirror up to those people. You know, I've heard of the comedian's philosophers thing previously, and I think to some degree there's some comics who can pull that off.
Yeah.
And I've never viewed myself as the kind of comic who's like, I'm speaking truth to power here, bub. I'm up here railing and saying what needs to be said. I don't think I'm saying things that are like need to be said and vital, but I do want to, and through my own experience, I just want to make you laugh, and I want to hold up a mirror to show you this, you look ridiculous. Let me show you how ridiculous you look right now.
Yeah, that's fun. It's almost like, yeah, you don't want to take yourself too seriously. You don't want to be that person who's like, I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna like undermine capitalism, and you're just like, how do I shoehorn that in there?
Right. You know, I've never been the kind of comic who is trying to get up there and say stuff that you'll agree with me on necessarily. Yeah. I don't want to get like clapped and do that. It's because that's the thing. It's like, I believe in the things that those comics say, right? Like I believe, I'm a liberal. I believe in like human rights and healthcare as a human right and all this stuff that I believe, but I also perform for audiences who don't believe that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I don't need to be the one who's like trying to change anybody's mind about that. That's not why I'm, it's not why you hired me to perform at your VFW in Arkansas, right? Yeah. You didn't hire me to perform there to like speak truth to power and be like, you guys are fucking wrong and you believe this, this is wrong. I'm not there to do, to rail against you for that. I'm there to make the jokes that will make you laugh at that. And that's the thing that I say this as somebody who's like, we're talking about Bill Hicks here, right? Bill Hicks is that guy who's like going up there and railing it to some degree and parts beyond this set. You know, especially in like Rant and E Minor, but he's up there saying that stuff and has this passion, but he's the kind of guy who like will be able to, he can perform that way and not feel that fear of like, oh, well, I'm going to turn some people off. Cause that's how skilled of a comic he is.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
You know, I say this, I'm still not, of course I'm not at that level. I would love to get to that level, but right now I'm still trying to figure out, okay, now I know what I believe. So how can I show off and explain and comment on the world as I see it in a way that you are going to laugh at no matter what? That's the trickiest thing to figure out. And that's something that in watching a set like this, you can see that Bill Hicks has figured that out.
Damn, I think you've summarized sort of how to gain a point of view in comedy, how to develop your comedic voice.
It's the hardest thing to develop. Yeah. It really is. And I've only recently felt like I've gotten to that point where I understand my voice, but like I still have to figure out how to communicate it. And that's the other half of the equation, right?
You mind if we go back into this Prolec thing?
No, yeah, let's go for
it. Okay, then... You know, with this idea of parenting and like the I guess the familial, he's like, you know, if, what was he talking about?
He's talking about, yeah, the pro-life people.
Pro-life people, he's going to show like the hypocrisy in what they do by talking about like them blocking health facilities. You know, if you're so pro-life, don't block health facilities. You know, if you're so pro-life, you know, you should be blocking cemeteries.
Which is just, I mean, that's the kind of same kind of thing too. It's like he's saying his beliefs, right? And he's saying them in a way that's so funny that you're gonna laugh at it no matter what, because all he's doing is holding up the mirror and saying, you're being ridiculous, look at how ridiculous you're being.
And he's positing a reality where it's like, how far can we extend this, like, I was gonna say anti-death, this pro-life sentiment, here he's being silly, right? He's being very critical throughout the set, but here he really kind of goes in a very silly avenue.
Yeah, and I think that silliness helps to temper the cultural criticism.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he does through a lot of the set, even beyond just this pro-life joke. You know, he's doing stuff is sort of a cultural critique. That's what his jokes are addressing in a very broad sense. But he's doing it in a very silly, absurd way.
Yeah. And it's very good.
I think it being so silly and absurd helps it be that good.
When you're
out there running around talking about shooting Billy Ray Cyrus in the face, you have to be able to laugh at the way he describes a shotgun, or the pacing of saying, we're coming my new TV show, let's hunt and kill Billy Ray Cyrus. Like, it's very different than I'm gonna kill Billy Ray Cyrus. That feels like a threat. Let's hunt and kill Billy Ray Cyrus. That's we're letting everybody in the hall, the audience is on board with that. We're going on a journey together. That's silly. Yeah. That's absurd. Saying, I'm going to kill Billy Ray Cyrus, that's the start of a manifesto. It's very different.
And like you mentioned that, and it feels like it should be obvious that you should be painting your narrative in that way. right? With like, I have this new show, right? But there are people who take a while to realize that you can't just go up there and say, I'm going to kill Billy Ray Cyrus.
Right. But that's the thing. It's like the fact that it takes a while for comics to figure out where the line is and like how to say things in a way that are funny instead of just like saying a thing. It really is night and day when you can see somebody who is a master of it, yeah. of word choice and phrasing and pacing, say things in a way that feels kind of melodic and musical and still gets the funny across.
Yeah, definitely. And then he goes on to talk about, he draws an equivalent between like the condescending nature of pro-lifers and non-smokers.
Mm-hmm. A common theme for Bill Hicks with the smoking and the non-smoking.
Yeah, the hill to die on.
Yeah, well, because he keeps talking about, this is something he's talked about in a lot of his albums, going back and forth between smoking and not smoking.
Yeah.
Because he would go through phases of not smoking and smoking again, and he'll always start off these smoking jokes. I notice he always starts it off by saying something like, I'm smoking again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
And you can see in this set the presence too when he says whatever that version of the line is. And there's some people who like cheer and clap sort of a beat too late for it to make sense at what they're clapping at. And he latches onto that and says something about it. He says something like, I don't know whether you're clapping for me smoking or for my imminent death or something like that.
Applauding me for starting or stopping.
There we go. Yeah.
Which that, you know, it seems like an ad lib in the moment sort of thing, but he's probably, you know, said that a few times.
Right. But even if he has, he's still playing into the illusion of, oh, this is off the cuff, even if it's not necessarily off the cuff. It's him being in the moment.
Jim, I hate to ask, but do you have a few of those?
Of what? Lines that are sort of like stock lines that I go back to for ad libs and stuff? Oh, yeah, of course. I think anybody who does enough crowd work or riffing, eventually you develop a sort of rhythm of like, oh, these are the things that work. So I'm going to try and steer the crowd, whoever I'm talking to, into this avenue.
Yeah, to give a sense of sort of spontaneity when I do hit the joke well enough.
Exactly. And that way it's still fun for me and I'm still there.
Yeah.
But I don't know what their reaction's going to be, and I still have to sort of choose your own adventure in my head.
Yeah. Then he goes, you know, hey, it's like, they applaud me for being a smoker or for starting or stopping, and you know, he acts out as a smoker, and he goes, hey, he's back. Yeah. But he also does the non-smoker, who's like, I can't believe you would go back to smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So I love how he introduces that, and then he starts talking about like if, you know, that whole scenario of the pearly gates is true, you know, he wouldn't be surprised if Saint Peter was like, hey man, you got a light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these aren't clouds. This is smoke.
This is cigarette smoke. Now come on in. We got Hendrix on harp tonight.
It tells you how much he loves smoking, man.
It
makes me want to start smoking. Not really, but. Talks about hell being a non-smoking section, and then he acts out like a non-smoker being in the hell, sort of reminding you of like he draws a line between people who are in hell and like how annoying non-smokers are, that they would be in hell.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
it's very funny.
Then he ends that with the act out of Saint Peter saying like, light up and come on in, Hendrix is on the harp tonight. Which is also very, I think, it's a big reference, but it's also out of, like, you don't expect it at all. Especially since it's Hendrix now playing the harp, which is
it's a great tag.
And then the last bit, he talks about traveling to Australia, which is, do you feel like he needed that segue?
To talk about traveling to Australia?
Talk about Easter.
Well, he's talking about stuff that's sort of adjacent to the stuff he's referencing, right? Like he's talking before this, he's talking about pro-life stuff, and then he makes heaven references. And now he's going into a bit that's overtly about Christianity, but he has to frame it in a way that Americans are going to understand what he's saying. Because, so you throw in the thing about, like, travel to Australia, this is how they celebrate Easter.
Yeah.
That's how you have to, that's how you can continue the cultural critique that he's sort of slyly been doing without hammering it. Now he can hammer, okay, I'm going to actively go in and make a joke that is about a Christian belief.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, it talks about bunny rabbits being there. He talks about, do you really think when Jesus comes back, he'd really want to look at another cross?
Right.
And then he does a little act out of him talking of Jesus talking to God and being like, you know, they still have crosses out there. How about come back as a bunny? Which is would you consider that a callback to that? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's definitely a callback. And that's why he ends the set on that too, because it's a callback. It's not the strongest punchline in the world. I think I've heard a version there. There's a lot of the jokes on this set that he does on Rant Knee Minor.
Yeah.
And I think that the album versions of the jokes, I prefer them to the set, honestly. But he covers such a broad set of material on this set in particular, that in order for him to end it in a clean way, he had to end on that bunny callback, because callbacks always work.
Yeah.
Audiences love a callback. It makes you feel smart when you pick up a callback, and it's not necessarily the hardest hitting punchline, but it's it's the recognition. And then also it's still funny on its own for him to say, oh, maybe I'll come back as a bunny, when he spent this whole other time talking about bunnies and chocolate and eggs and all this stuff.
Yeah, and these are
so. Yeah, it's just how it worked.
Cool. I think we thoroughly went through the set. I think, dude, you're fantastic. This is very insightful.
Thanks. You know, and I really do hope that people should watch this set. And I think that the backstory of it too, not to go on too long about it, but the reason why this set is banned or was banned, very interesting to me, is not because of the stuff that you, if we're talking now, might expect, because of the stuff he says, the jokes about gay couples. That's the thing that you would think now that something like this might be banned for, right?
Yeah.
If you look at what happened and you read that New York article you were talking about earlier, these jokes got banned because of the jokes about pro-life people and about Easter and Christianity.
Yeah.
And that is crazy to me that happened for that reason. And I think that reading the whole story behind this set and then knowing what Bill Hicks's sort of role that he assumed as a comedian and a cultural commentator and cultural critic, seeing that his jokes were banned without him knowing about it for this reason, it's very silly, but I think it adds to this level of why I think Bill Hicks is still an important comic, even if he's saying stuff that people don't necessarily agree with or saying things in a way that is not to your liking. I think he's an important comic to pay attention to.
Yeah, and there's something about his death coming like within the following year,
mm-hmm.
and how he did not like he left, you know, he died like believing like that this topic that was banned, that he never got to see sort of whether or not these were his real intentions. He never got to see the fruit of his labor.
Right,
it just became more commonplace to understand like the hypocrisies or the ironies of religion. And,
mm-hmm.
It's a bummer, but he was a very important and still is a very important figure in comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I still put Rant Knee Minor up in the all-time great comedy albums. Rant Knee Minor in particular is one of those albums that has stuff going on for it besides just stand-up. There's music on there, he's performing, he's doing a little singing. There's some interludes and stuff in there mixed in. And it's one of the things that when I was talking to Coach about producing the album,
yeah.
I was like, this is a reference for me that I think we should keep in mind. Like, this album separates itself from being just a guy telling jokes. There's something else going on here. There's something else that keeps you intrigued and listening. And so that's what I wanted to try and achieve with Good Guy with a Gun.
Cool. I think that's the best way to wrap this up. You know, you've clearly described all the hard work and intention you've put into this album. I'm going to do my best on my behalf to get this across to people to realize, like, why, other than just it being super funny, why they should be picking up this album. And I wish that I could go to, like, Amoeba Records right now and, like, literally take it off the shelf, you know?
Oh, God, that would be so nice.
But I guess I'm going to have to click something instead.
Yeah, just do a couple clicks. Click the links in my bio, and you'll be good to go.
Yeah. We can find you on all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and all those. You have links to your bio, right? You're on the
right. Yeah, I'm at Diet J on Twitter and Instagram. My Facebook is J Light Comedy. My website is jlightcomedy.com, and the bio, or, you know, all of those avenues have links very prominently placed where you can pre-order the album. It's currently streaming exclusively on Pandora and on SiriusXM. It's going to go officially released to all platforms on August 14th. So pre-order it. Give me an early birthday present. I promise you it is worth your time and your money. I wouldn't be out here evangelizing it so much if it wasn't.
Yeah. And if I can end on the if I can end the podcast recording on this, Jay, this was such a delight. This is one of the reasons I started this podcast, to have conversations like this.
Dude, Joe, I love talking craft. I love talking the form and the format. I think it's something that I miss about doing stand-up, is hanging out with comics and talking about the craft of performing and doing and joke writing. So I'm happy to do it with you today.
Oh, well, thank you for being on. And I think we've killed that frog.
We destroyed that frog. We decimated it, Joe. Nice work. Partner in crime.
All right, we're out of here.